Welcome to Breast Cancer Briefing, the podcast where we are breaking down the latest research and science in breast cancer, one conversation at a time. I am your host, Sarah Nunnery. I'm a breast oncologist and director of breast cancer research at Tennessee Oncology. And I'm really excited about this episode where we're focusing in on reconstruction options for patients who've had breast cancer. So I'm joined by two fabulous plastic surgeons where I get to ask them some questions and hear some of their expertise on these reconstruction options. So first off, we have Dr. Mei Yang. She is an amazing board-certified plastic surgeon who attended the Ohio State University for Medical School, where she completed a really competitive dual degree program, obtaining both her MD and MBA from the Fisher College of Business. She then completed her integrated plastic surgery residency at Loyola Medical Center in Chicago. Then she went on to complete an aesthetic fellowship at Partners in Plastic Surgery with Dr. Dennis Hammond, who's one of the top three plastic surgeons in the U.S. Dr. Yang now practices plastic surgery here in Nashville, Tennessee, where she really specializes in both cosmetic and reconstructive surgery. A large portion of her practice is reconstruction for patients with breast cancer. She has extensive expertise in implant-based reconstruction for patients with breast cancer. And then also joining us is Dr. Odette Ghanem. She completed medical school at the American University of Beirut, followed by her plastic and reconstructive surgery residency at the American University of Beirut Medical Center. She completed two fellowships at Vanderbilt University Medical Center, craniomaxillofacial surgery and aesthetics. She then completed a fellowship in reconstructive microsurgery at Johns Hopkins. She's now back in Nashville at Vanderbilt on faculty as an assistant professor of plastic and reconstructive surgery. So I am really excited to welcome both of you to the podcast. Thank you so much for taking the time to be here.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to just start us off with some of the basics. If a patient is new in this whole breast cancer process, there's a lot of different plastic surgeons out there, and there's a whole lot of different training pathways to get into plastic surgery. So just want to get your take, Dr. Yang. Will you tell us a little bit about, what do you think a patient should look for when they're looking for a plastic surgeon for reconstruction? You know, are there specific qualifications that they need to look for? Like, what would you recommend to someone?
So first, making sure that you're going to somebody who is either board certified or board eligible in plastic surgery is very important. There's a lot of people out there who are certified in cosmetic surgery, which I would not say you get the same training as a board certified or board eligible plastic surgeon. Other things that I would look for, you know, seeing if they have reviews before and afters, especially in breast reconstruction or breast surgery. You don't necessarily want to go to somebody who's focused in facial surgery for kind of breast reconstruction.
No, those are great points. Thank you for clarifying some of that. And then another thing that I also want a little bit more information on, Dr. Ghanem, to you, will you tell us a little bit about reconstructive microsurgery? Like, what exactly does that mean, and how's that different from other basic types of reconstructive surgery?
Yeah, I actually love to answer this question because I feel like most patients, the first time they hear a microsurgery and free flaps is when they get the cancer diagnosis.
Yeah.
There are a lot of technical words that they read about online, and it can get very overwhelming and it can seem intimidating, but it doesn't have to be. So basically, microsurgery is whenever we remove tissues from the body with their dedicated blood vessels, and then we move these tissues to another part of the body, and then we connect those blood vessels together under a microscope. The vessels usually are very, very tiny, like 1 to 2 millimeters in size, and we use sutures that are thinner than our hair in order to do the suturing. So it is definitely a complex procedure from a technical standpoint. And that's why, circling back to your first question, I think if a patient is really considering autologous reconstruction, looking for a surgeon that is specially trained for those types of procedures is very important because they are very technical and complex. And seeking those in centers that do them very often is very important. All the data that looked into decreasing the complication rates and the flap success have actually supported that high volume centers or high volume surgeons that do very often these procedures, like on a weekly basis, usually have better success rates in general. So I think that's also like a very important thing to look for, especially if a patient is considering autologous reconstruction and microsurgery.
Quite a few more questions for you in a minute to get into more about that, those autologous reconstruction options. I want to start out with getting some input from you, Dr. Yang, on some implant-based reconstruction options. Will you explain for us first two kind of different types that I feel like patients hear about the most and talk about the most, and that's direct-to-implant reconstruction versus delayed reconstruction. Will you take us through both of those processes? What are they? How are they different?
Yeah, so I would say there's immediate reconstruction versus delayed reconstruction.
Okay.
And in the branch of immediate reconstruction, we can either do direct-to-implant, where at the time of mastectomy, we immediately put an implant or a permanent device in the breast to reconstruct, or the other option is we put a temporary device or a tissue expander in. I would say more often than not, we're putting a tissue expander in, and reasons why we do a tissue expander instead of an immediate implant is, number one, the blood supply. So whenever we're doing a mastectomy, you're losing about 90% of the blood supply to our skin because we're taking out all that breast tissue with those blood vessels. And so putting too much pressure on that skin with, you know, a larger implant could compromise that skin. And so that's why we do a tissue expander. The second reason I like to tell patients is because they don't get to make many decisions in breast cancer. You don't decide that you want cancer. You don't decide, you know, certain aspects. But one of the things that we can decide is their size. And how we're able to do that with a tissue expander is slowly inflate that tissue expander until we get to a size implant that that patient wants. Certain people who are good candidates for direct-to-implant-based reconstruction are people who want to have a smaller implant size, skinnier patients, who we don't have many options for fat grafting or other autologous things. And then with delayed reconstruction, that would be somebody who had a mastectomy and either decided not to have reconstruction, which would be like a flat closure, or somebody who had to have an immediate mastectomy, needed to get into treatment faster, and so at that point had to have a flat closure, and then they come back and see us to get a tissue expander put in to stretch the skin and then eventually get an implant-based breast reconstruction.
Will you tell us a little bit more about tissue expander? How do those work? I feel like that's something patients always ask me in clinic when we talk about it. They're like, how is this going to get filled? Will you talk us through that?
So I like to explain to people that a tissue expander is basically a glorified water balloon. So we put in a spacer into the space. It has a small port, kind of like a chemo port, and that once the patient's incisions have healed, usually around the four-week mark, we have them come in on a weekly basis, use a very small butterfly needle, and inject saline through that port and slowly fill them on a weekly basis till they get to their desired size. What's great about that is we can try out sizes. We can inflate expanders and deflate them just as easily. So if they think they're too big, then we can go back down a size.
Yeah, that's amazing. In terms of implants, this is something else that I feel like we get a lot of questions about in the clinic. We're most familiar for two main types of breast implants, silicone and saline. Can you tell us, are there pros and cons for each of those? And are there specific ones that you tend to recommend the most when you're doing reconstruction?
Yeah. So saline is just what it sounds like, a bag of water. So you're going to see a lot more rippling with that. And so I usually recommend doing silicone implants. Back in the early 90s, early 2000s, people actually took silicone implants off the market because they were doing a lot of studies to see if silicone implants could make people sick. All the studies came back and said, no, actually, silicone implants are safe. So they came back to market, and now we have these nice cohesive silicone implants. So again, back when we did those studies, they were filled more like Elmer's glue consistency silicone. So when they leaked, they were kind of runny through the body, and that's what caused issues. Well, now these implants on the market are very cohesive gummy bear implants, meaning we cut them in half. They're not going to leak anymore.
Right.
And they stay within their capsule. So they give us a much more natural look. And then something we can pair with these implants is fat grafting, where we do liposuction to the tummy area or some problem areas, and then we transfer that up into the breast to make it look more natural, kind of mimic breast tissue. But it does not put you at a higher risk for breast cancer. It does not make any future breast cancers harder to find. Just gives us a more natural look.
Are there any, or I guess I would ask, you know, how often would you guess you're doing silicone implants now versus saline?
I can know in the past 3 years, I have put 2 saline implants in patients with breast reconstruction. Everyone else got silicone implants.
Okay. Wow. That's amazing. In terms of reconstruction, where do the implants go? Are they right on the chest wall, into the muscle? Tell us a little bit about that.
So, you know, back when I first trained, we always were putting implants underneath the muscle. Mm-hmm. And why we were doing that is we had not so great implants. And so we were hiding those implants from the body to decrease scar tissue. Well, now we have different things like meshes and acellular dermal matrix, which are big fancy words for basically a little envelope that we can wrap these implants in. And so now we're able to put them on top of the muscle. And the reason I like to put them on top of the muscle is, number one, our pain is a lot less. So we don't have to cut that muscle. Mm-hmm. Number two, we don't get something called animation deformity, which means whenever you flex your pec muscle, your implant used to move. And so now going on top of the muscle, our implants look a lot more natural. We don't get that animation deformity, and we don't have pain or implant displacement over time.
And would you say the recovery is a lot easier?
Recovery is a lot easier. There's no range of motion restrictions, just lifting restrictions right after surgery.
That's great to hear. I want to shift things over to you, Dr. Ghanem, and talk more about autologous reconstruction. Mm-hmm. You explained microsurgery so well in this concept of moving tissue around the body. I think just as a medical oncologist, the most common type of autologous reconstruction that I feel like we're used to seeing is deep flap. Mm-hmm. Would you explain for us what deep flap is? And then are there any other really common autologous reconstruction options for patients as well? And maybe too, I should ask you, could you also just kind of define for us what autologous reconstruction means?
So basically, autologous reconstruction is when you're doing reconstruction from your own tissues. We're not using any prosthetics or implants whatsoever for the reconstruction. So when we talk about deep flaps, it's deep as in D-I-E-P,
yes.
Flap, is just an acronym for the name of the blood vessels that are dedicated to that particular tissue, which is deep inferior epigastric perforator flap. It's just like a fancy acronym for the name of the blood vessel,
yes.
Similar to all other types of flaps we use in reconstruction. So the deep flap essentially involves removing the tissues in the lower belly, that is between the belly button and the pubic bone, very similar to the tissues that we remove during a tummy tuck procedure, mm-hmm. with incisions that are very similar to tummy tuck incisions as well. Sometimes the incision can be a little bit higher depending on the patient's anatomy, but it's very similar in general, in like one big incision from hip bone to hip bone and one around the belly button. Mm-hmm. And then the tissues that we usually remove in a tummy tuck, in a deep flap, we actually keep it with its blood supply, and then we transplant it onto the chest. So then we connect the artery and the vein, so the blood vessels for those tissues to blood vessels in the chest in order to keep it alive, essentially. Mm-hmm. And usually what we do is pre-op, we get a CT scan of the belly with a special type of dye in the vein as well, in order to take a look about the specific anatomy of the patient. It just helps in planning for the surgery and in counseling for the patient, because some patients might have a more difficult anatomy, and it's an important conversation to have pre-op. And then at the time of the surgery, it's like 6 to 8 hours for a unilateral case, 8 to 10 for a bilateral case. That's at least like the national average. Of course, some surgeons are faster, some surgeons take more time. And it all depends, again, on like getting that in a center where the surgical team is familiar, the nurses are familiar with those flaps. So it's definitely a bigger surgery on the upfront if we compare it to like prosthetic surgery involving implants. But we can talk more, obviously, about the long-term benefits of those types of surgeries, but usually that's how the process goes. It does involve staying in the hospital for 2 to 3 days after the surgery, and that's mainly because not the patient herself needs to stay in the hospital, but because the flaps need the very close monitoring. That's when the nurse goes every hour and checks the blood supply on the flaps and make sure they're doing well for 2 days. And then because the highest risk of having any problems with those flaps is within 24 hours mm-hmm. after the surgery. So that's why we keep the patients for 2 days for close monitoring of the flaps. And if everything looks good, then they can go home afterwards.
Wow.
So other forms of reconstruction, why we talk about deeps is because that is like the gold standard mm-hmm. when it comes to autologous. However, sometimes patients might not be good candidates for a deep flap, whether they had like a previous tummy tuck before, so the okay. tissues are not available, mm-hmm. or some patients, they've had previous abdominal surgery with big scars on the belly that can actually compromise the blood supply.
Got it.
And so when we do the CT scan, they're not really good candidates for deeps. That's when we can choose other forms of autologous reconstruction. And the second location we go to is the thighs, and that's the upper inner parts of the thighs, tissues that we usually remove in a thigh lift. Now, okay. instead of removing it and discarding it like we do in a thigh lift, we actually keep it with its dedicated blood supply and we transplant it onto the chest. There's another location, which is the lower back, which is like the area we call the muffin top. If
okay.
you're like wearing
yes.
your jeans and you have those lower yes. handles. So those also can be harvested in something called a lap flap.
Wow.
And also we can remove from the buttocks tissue. The back and the buttocks, it's longer surgery with more complication rates. So these are like the less preferred go-to option in autologous. And that's why we always go for the belly or the thighs first before mm-hmm. we consider other sites. Mm-hmm. One other form of autologous reconstruction I think is very important for patients to be aware of is one that does not involve, obviously, implants, does not involve these long, big, complex surgeries with long recoveries. It's called Goldilocks procedure. And that is a very minimalistic, like the most minimal type of reconstructive work that some patients actually just want.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be done at the time of the mastectomy, where we just rearrange the tissues, the skin of the breast envelope of the breast skin, and we make a small mound out of it. Usually the good candidates are patients who are large breasted,
mm-hmm.
And the reconstructed breast is very, very small. It's
okay.
better than just for specific patients, they find it better than just being flat, and at the same time, it's better than going through stage reconstruction and more complex surgeries that involve more recovery. So that is technically an autologous form of reconstruction
sure.
because we're still using the breast's own skin envelope to make a small mound out of it. So it's also one option that for some patients might be their best option.
So it's something to consider if someone is just really not wanting an implant, mm-hmm. but they don't want a big surgery either.
Mm-hmm.
You also mentioned about the hospital stay. And you know, needing to check the flaps for perfusion every hour, that typically means ICU, correct? A night in the ICU for most places.
Mm-hmm.
What about for you, Dr. Yang, like for implant-based procedures, those are typically all outpatient, correct?
Yeah, so traditionally they were overnight stays.
Right.
But then during COVID, there were a lot of studies minimizing, you know, inpatient stays or overnight stays. And so I would say about half of my breast surgeons send their patients home same day after the mastectomy. There's a lot of great anesthesia options, especially because we're going on top of the muscle.
Right.
It's a lot less pain. And then we also do things like pec blocks that will last us 24 to
okay.
48 hours and other pain interventions. So depending on your breast surgeon, either a 23-hour night stay or home same day.
Okay, yeah, so just something else helpful for our patients to be aware of and for us to be aware of as mm-hmm. medical oncologists too, because we certainly get a lot of these questions. You kind of touched on this already, Dr. Ghanem, about you know, being able to determine if someone is a candidate for a deep flap or not, because not everybody is. You mentioned, you know, prior abdominal surgeries. Are there any other reasons that someone would not be a candidate for an autologous reconstruction?
No, it's basically just obviously the previous abdominal surgery that affects the blood supply or a previous tummy tuck. There are just certain risk factors that are not necessarily like contraindications for the procedures. It just increases the risk of the surgery. It's mostly diabetes, having a higher BMI, smoking. That's why we always tell patients they have to stop smoking at least 4 weeks before the surgery, 4 weeks after the surgery, because nicotine can constrict the smaller blood vessels, and the surgery is all about small blood vessels.
Right.
Essentially, these are just risk factors. Even patients who have blood clotting problems, it's still not a contraindication, but it does increase the risk of the success of the flaps. And that's why very often those patients have to go on some form of blood thinner medication after the surgery. So it's just some extra work when we have risk factors. But for the most part, like besides previous abdominal surgery or the lack of tissues in the lower belly, there's not pretty much contraindications for the deep flap.
Yeah.
On the upsides, thinking about it, is just, again, it's a very complex surgery. On the upfront, it definitely demands more recovery. But then once that is done, then that's it. So, like, I always tell the patient that once it's done, you get a reconstruction for life. Mm-hmm. You don't have a surveillance of an implant to deal with, and you don't have to consider any revision procedures later on, which are very common with prosthetic procedures. Mm-hmm. And autologous reconstruction feels more natural, looks more natural, as our belly tissue feels and looks more natural to our breast tissue. And so definitely, like, on the longer term, it's lesser, it's more durable and less of maintenance form of reconstruction. But definitely on the shorter term, it's definitely more demanding from the recovery standpoint.
Sure. And when you're seeing patients, Dr. Yang, is there any, you know, big red flags in terms of comorbidities or things that make you think a patient's not a good candidate for any, you know, types of implant-based reconstruction, or is it really a good option for most patients?
Yeah, so my whole thing is making sure we're optimized for the best outcome possible. So I personally have kind of strict guidelines because these are patients who have breast cancer, and they need a lot of times treatment after surgery. And so if I'm delaying that treatment because we're having risks or complications, I want to minimize those risks or complications. So in general, BMI of 35 or less is ideal for our patients, because once our BMI goes above 35, our risk of infection, especially because we're putting a foreign device in your body, your risk of infection is higher. Risk of having issues with even anesthesia or healing complications, those increase with a BMI of over 35.
Yeah.
Echoing the same thing with smoking. So I have a strict no smoking policy as well, because again, we're taking away not just for microvascular, but for wound healing in general.
Right.
We're relying on those tiny little blood vessels in our skin to heal that skin. And then diabetes, having a hemoglobin A1C of 7 or less really decreases our risk of infection. So those are the main things that I look for in patients.
And those are certainly things that, you know, it sounds like a patient, if they wanted to be really proactive to help improve their outcome, you know, they can work on those things like leading up to surgery and try to improve. So you gave a good segue for me to some of the other questions I want to ask about. And that is that, yes, we have a lot of treatments that we might have to give our patients for their breast cancer, chemotherapy, radiation. We have a lot of new targeted therapies and immunotherapies that we're using now to treat breast cancer. So in terms of implant-based reconstruction, if someone needs chemotherapy or radiation, how does that affect the timeline for reconstruction? You know, do things have to be sequenced a certain way, or can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, so if you're getting your mastectomy and either direct to implant or expander-based reconstruction with immediate reconstruction, we recommend holding off on chemo for 4 weeks before that surgery and at least 4 weeks after, because what chemo does is it lowers a lot of numbers. And so we want to make sure that we have our numbers as high as possible. If we have to get radiation, we usually like to radiate with tissue expanders in place.
Okay.
So we'll drain one of the expanders, the side that is not getting radiated, we'll drain it down so that that breast does not get any aberrant radiation rays.
Okay.
What's great about new expanders that we have on the market actually is a Motiva expander is a does not have a magnet. So it's all the other expanders had magnets in them, which when you get CT planning, there's a lot of scatter with that. And so these new Motiva expanders have come to market and they actually have a 60% less damage to healthy tissue. So they're able to really focus and plan, and radiation oncologists are able to plan a lot better and really target that cancer with less damage to the rest of the breast, which is great and helps with our reconstruction. But radiation is like a bad sunburn. We have immediate effects, kind of like when your skin peels, and then we have late effects when your skin tightens. And so I like to wait at least 6 months after radiation. There's a nice cooling off period I give my patients before we go and do implant-based, their second stage reconstruction.
Okay. In terms of like autologous reconstruction, does that generally come later after all of these adjuvant treatments that we give, or can it be fit in? What is the approach there?
Again, if it's chemotherapy, then we have to wait like 4 weeks before, 4 weeks after, same thing. When it comes to radiation, there's a little bit of a difference. Ideally, when it comes to radiation, after the last radiation session, we wait 9 months, even 12 months to do the autologous reconstruction. And the reason is that the vessels in the chest that we use in order to connect the vessels from the belly or the thighs, those get radiated. And so they get some radiation damage. And for that damage to recover, it does take time. So we usually wait 9 months to 12 months to do that reconstruction. Now there are a lot of data that are on the rise about actually being 6 weeks after the last radiation session being a safe window. Before the long-term radiation effect sets in. Historically, it's been classical to just wait 9 to 12 months.
Right.
And sometimes the patients are just not ready for a big surgery 6 weeks right after they finish radiation and chemo and all these things. But now it's also an option, as it has been shown that that is, again, a safer window with a better success rate. But everything in between usually is a window we don't like to do any big flaps during.
No, that makes sense. And in terms of tissue expanders, I think this just came up for clinic. It came up in clinic for me the other day. So like, yes, totally safe to have expanders when you're going through radiation and for chemo as well, correct? They just stay there and
correct.
We do our treatments and then can go back later for the second stage. In terms of some of these other novel therapies that we're using now for breast cancer, we have, you know, our HER2 targeted antibody treatments that we give. We have CDK4/6 inhibitors now that are oral targeted agents that we're giving women who have more high risk hormone driven breast cancer. Then we have immunotherapy that we give as well for triple negative breast cancer. So I know our treatment toolbox keeps expanding. Are there any of these new treatments that are concerning and could negatively affect, reconstruction plans? Anything that worries you or specific treatments that could impact that you like to hold off doing reconstruction while a patient's on? Or do we not know yet for some of these?
We do not know yet is maybe the best answer.
Yes, that's
because
fair.
Because that field is going very fast.
Yes.
And there's not really enough of data. We're still learning about how these things affect reconstruction. For example, tamoxifen was something we used to stop 1 month before doing a free flap. Mm-hmm. And now we keep patients on tamoxifen. So things are evolving as these medications are more and more used and we understand more about them and how they can affect wound healing, and sometimes it's just this is where like a multidisciplinary care team is important.
Right.
This is where communication with radiation oncologists and the oncologist and obviously the surgical oncologist is very, very important. And with these medications, it's always a back and forth with the oncologist, seeing when it's a safe window for the patient in terms of the counts, like their blood counts, in order to be able to perform like a reconstructive surgery, whether it's just implants or autologous. So for the most part, part of these medications, there's no one set particular recommendation that is agreed on, but it's mostly individualized. It's more on the individual level.
I think that's fair and very well said. And that's why I like that you're highlighting the importance of having a care team that communicates. It certainly makes it so much easier for us when we know our plastic surgeon and can communicate. And I think from an oncology standpoint, you know, really the only things that worry us is when, yes, a patient's on an immunosuppressive medication that can lower the blood counts, you know, and increase the risk of infection and wound healing. But, you know, I think we are learning more ourselves about the effects of immunotherapy, some of these new HER2 targeted therapies that we're using. So that's helpful to know. I want to also shift gears and talk a little bit about some other sort of reconstruction new things that we're hearing a lot more about. Maybe this isn't totally new, but maybe new for some patients. Dr. Yang, will you tell us a bit about like oncoplastic procedures or oncoplastic reduction? I see patients all the time and they have no idea that these things are options. So what does that mean? What are some of those other procedures?
Yeah, so instead of just getting a traditional mastectomy, patients can also get lumpectomies, which means that they just remove that portion of the cancer. Well, classically, a lot of times that leaves a little divot and then you get radiated and then that divot gets worse. And so what they've started doing is in conjunction with us as plastic surgeons, I meet with a patient, a lot of these patients are larger breasted and have always wanted a breast reduction or a breast lift. And so at the same time as the lumpectomy, what we will do is on that lumpectomy side, we will lift the nipple, tighten the skin, rearrange the breast tissue so that we don't have any divots or dimples in the skin and that everything is nice and smooth. And then on the opposite side, we will do a lift and reduction on that side so that we aren't cattywampus or don't have, you know, an asymmetry. With a lumpectomy, the majority of those patients are going to get radiated. And so with radiation, 95% of the time, that breast tightens and shrinks a little bit.
Right.
So we kind of have to make a little calculation in our head. And usually on the unaffected side that's not going to get radiated, I will tighten that and lift it a little bit more.
Sure.
So that when we come out of radiation, we're more symmetric.
Is that something that all patients should be asking about as an option? I feel like it's just something patients don't know is an option. Is everybody a candidate or is it more like breast size, cancer size? How does that come into play?
Yeah, I think it really starts with a conversation with the oncologist and the breast surgeon. And if they are a candidate for either a lumpectomy or a mastectomy, I think a lumpectomy is definitely something to discuss. It's more of a one surgery. We don't have to put an implant in. Mm-hmm. You do have to get radiation and you do have to get follow-up mammograms versus if you get a mastectomy, you won't have to do mammograms in the future because we don't have breast tissue to monitor. Mm-hmm. So those are all things that we have to, you know, weigh and benefit. However, they've done those studies where they show long-term, if you get a lumpectomy versus a mastectomy, survivability or how long you live is equal between the two groups.
Right. Some of the other new procedures that we're hearing about, and I can definitely open this up to both of you because I think both of you do these procedures, and that is sensation-preserving mastectomy. Maybe Dr. Gunham, can you tell us, what does that mean?
Obviously, when a mastectomy is done, all the nerves that give the sensation to the breast skin, they're cut. And sometimes, even in what we call nipple-sparing mastectomy, when the mastectomy is done, but we keep the nipple and the areola, the sensation to the nipple and the areola is also gone. And I think this is one of the most exciting fields right now in breast reconstruction. There's a very big trial called Resensation Trial that is actually trying to look into neurotizing the nipple and the areola when we keep them, or even just the skin in general. The mastectomy flap at first is numb. The patient are not going to feel anything on it. With time, they start to gain back some sensation that we like to call like a protective sensation. So you feel like there's something there, but it's not really a sensation. And this affects quality of life more than anything. Patients, sometimes they tell you, I can't feel my grandkids when I hug them.
Oh, wow.
Or I can't feel, like we see a lot of burns to the chest skin because patients are cooking and they can't feel their skin and they get burned. burned. So it's definitely, and of course, from an intimacy standpoint, mm-hmm. even when we keep the nipple and the areola, it's actually even less satisfying than when the nipple and the areola are removed during a mastectomy, because they're there, but there's no sensation right. whatsoever. So there's actually a study that looked into it, and it showed that nipple sparing mastectomies are less satisfactory to patients if the nipple is not neurotized,
wow.
meaning if it's not innervated again.
Yeah.
So these procedures involve using nerve grafts in order to connect the nerves from the lateral chest into the skin or the area under the nipple and the areola, or even if that's removed during the mastectomy, under the skin of the chest. And that improves with time. And when I say with time, I'm talking 12 months to 24 months. So it takes like a year or two to get a meaningful improvement in the sensation. But like the largest study on that showed 80% of patients actually reported a much improved sensation in the skin, and hence a much improved satisfaction with the reconstruction and quality of life, and just you know the intimacy in general, as they have more sensation of their skin or of the nipple areola also that is preserved.
Mm-hmm.
That all being said, all the data is very promising, but none is like solid data like with
okay.
other forms of reconstruction. So that's why it's still a very evolving field. Even if patient gets a flap reconstruction, like a deep flap, we can neurotize deep flaps, and those also increase sensation and increase how the patient is feeling in general about her new
wow.
breast after the reconstruction.
Are these options that you know, a patient can only get at a large academic center, you know, for a lot of our patients who are in more rural areas that can't necessarily travel, or are there plastic surgeons in the community, which may be more question for you, Dr. Yang, who can offer some of these procedures for patients?
Yeah, I definitely offer it for my patients. It's becoming more and more common
okay.
for plastic surgeons to offer this. The real issue that we're having is with insurance companies, actually. So getting insurance companies to approve neurotization, I would say about half of them do right now. And so it is a financial burden if they don't,
yeah.
and the patient wants to go through that. Besides just, intimacy and being able to feel, it also helps prevent something called post-mastectomy pain syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So if those nerves grow back inappropriately, I've had a couple of patients have really painful sensations, which, means more surgery or other kinds of treatments. And it's very hard to pinpoint when people have nerve pain where it's coming from. So now we're just kind of working on making sure that insurance companies are covering it and battling that fight. Because otherwise, it's about $5,000 per side for the nerve grafting.
Wow. Yeah, no, that's definitely something that I've heard come up quite a bit. I think it's gotten a lot of attention on social media as well. And so helpful. So I think it's really important for a patient to make sure their plastic surgeon is very experienced in breast cancer reconstruction, board certified and able to do these procedures safely. The other thing that is really exciting is lymphovenous bypass surgery. And I think that's something that I know is being performed at Vanderbilt. Can you explain what that is and when that might be something to consider for a patient?
Mm-hmm. So obviously, first of all, what is lymphedema? That's when the arm on the side of the cancer becomes swollen with time, and it becomes uncomfortable, painful, heavy, causes more infections on the skin. And I think it's one of the most debilitating long-term problems of breast cancer is when a patient gets lymphedema. It is more common in patients that get a full axillary dissection at the time of the cancer surgery.
Mm-hmm.
And so there are two things we can do for that, a preventative approach and a treatment approach. So for preventative approach, there's a procedure that is we abbreviate as LYMPHA, and that is at the time of the axillary dissection, because patients who get axillary dissection have like 20 to 40% risk of getting lymphedema on
right,
that side
right.
versus patients who do only lymph node sampling,
mm-hmm.
they have a way less risk. Sometimes it's reported between 5 to 10%, but sometimes even less in order to get lymphedema on that side. So for patients that will get full dissection. What we do is at the time of the surgery, we go in after the breast surgeon, and then we inject a dye under the skin between the fingers, and then also on the inner side of the arm, and then we take a look about all the lymphatic vessels in the axilla, and those lymphatic vessels would be cut because of the axillary dissection. Mm-hmm. And so we take these lymphatic vessels, which are like 0.2 to 0.3 millimeters in size, very, very tiny.
Wow.
And then we reroute them to very, very tiny veins in the axilla. So those lymphatics, which are channels that are taking all this lymph fluid from the arm, have somewhere to go. Otherwise, this fluid cannot drain and it keeps congesting in the arm, and that's how the arm gets swollen with time, and it only gets worse with time. Of course, there are non-surgical management approaches like lymphatic massages, well-fitted compressive garments. But the advantage of lymphoma is the fact that it's preventative. So we do it at the time of the axillary dissection in order to decrease the risk of getting lymphedema. Again, this is an ongoing field of study. Results are promising, but it's not still very solid evidence. Okay. The biggest study on those have showed that the risk drops from around 40% to around 10 to 12.5% in two different studies. So one showed 10, one showed 12.5. But again, this is a significant difference. Yeah. If you can have like 40 out of 100 patients drop to 10,
right,
of getting such a debilitating long-term condition by doing this procedure at the time of the mastectomy, then why not? The other option is if the patient has already had the lymphedema, then that's when we do lymphovenous bypass.
Got it.
That's when we go look for the tiny lymphatics along the arm, under the skin, right, under the skin, and we reroute those lymphatics that are still open, but they have nowhere to go to, into smaller veins in order to help drain that. There is one other surgery, but that's for more advanced lymphedema. So if there are no open smaller channels in the arm, then what do we do? Because the lymphedema is now advanced, all of the channels are now not working, we don't have anything to reroute to veins. That's when we do something called lymph node transfer. And that's, again, microsurgery. It's a big, complex surgery where we can remove lymph nodes from other parts of the body, like the groin or sometimes from inside the belly, and then we can transplant those on the axilla in order to help drain the arm. But obviously, the more advanced the lymphedema is, the tougher the procedures become and the lesser the success rate.
And are you seeing that get reimbursed by payers?
Lymphedema may be better than neurotization in general.
Okay.
But again, it's not as more readily accepted by insurances as
Got
other
it.
Forms of reconstruction.
So if we're seeing patients in clinic and we have someone who may be just struggling with really debilitating lymphedema, is that something we should be looking for to find someone who does microsurgery and does those procedures?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, that's great to hear. Any final takeaways that we should cover that you want to leave patients with that we haven't touched on?
So I would say, you know, just because you go down one door of reconstruction does not mean that closes all the other doors to reconstruction. If a patient decides to do a flat closure, that doesn't mean that they can't have reconstruction in the future. Another big thing that I like to, you know, tell my patients is that this is their cancer journey. This is not my journey. This is not your journey. Mm-hmm. So whatever reconstruction is going to fit with their lifestyle and fit with, you know, their goals and desires is, you know, it's their decision and their choice.
Yeah. Awesome. Anything else you want to add?
No, absolutely. Just to second Dr. Yang, it's definitely the patient's choice. Sometimes all options are valid for a patient, and it all depends on their goal and priorities. Mm-hmm. And I always tell patients, you can always shift routes. Like, you can get implants, say, oh, this is not working for me, shift to autologous, you can get autologous, and then shift to implants. So they feel so much better once they know that they can, that it's not, you know, like, done deal, that they can always shift. And I would say just advocate for yourself. So like ask a lot of questions. If you don't feel comfortable with your reconstructive surgeon, then have a second opinion with someone else. I feel like even because if you think about it, even once they're done with the cancer and they're cured, they don't see their oncologist, they don't see their surgical oncology surgeon, but they keep seeing their plastic surgeon. So that's something that even years down the line, that's a provider you're going to keep mm-hmm. going to. So really feeling that you're comfortable and heard with the choice of your plastic surgeon is very important because it's one of the members of the care team that you're going to be seeing for some time once you embark on a breast reconstruction journey.
It's so true. Absolutely. Well, I honestly learned so much from this conversation myself. So thank you both so much for being here, for taking the time, for sharing all your expertise. We really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having us.